This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
I'm hiding in Honduras. I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns, and money. This shit has hit the fan.
Hi folks, Bob Main here with another episode of the Handgun World Show. Episode number 79 to be exact. And it is Monday the 23rd of August 2010. This is a little bit early. I've been putting the shows out mainly on Wednesdays. But this is a special interview that I had a chance to conduct recently. So I want you to hear it because the next show that I put out probably Wednesday or Thursday of this week is going to be about my close range gunfighting course that I just took this past weekend at Suarez International. Got a lot of good stuff for you on that. But this that you're going to hear today was pre-recorded. It was pre-recorded last week. And I wanted you to hear this before you hear my synopsis on the close-range gunfighting course from Suarez International. Because a lot of what you're going to hear today in this interview, a lot of it has to do with my experiences at the course, and they correlate, and there's a lot of similarities, and there's some differences. So it's going to be pretty fitting for you to hear this right now. As I've mentioned many times on this show, I am no expert when it comes to shooting. I have a lot to learn. And one of the reasons why I do this podcast, folks, is it helps me, too. That's one of the bigger reasons why I do this. So whenever I get a chance to learn from somebody who's better at me, or better than me, at doing something, I jump all over that. So I had a chance to interview Steve Zopfi. I hope, Steve, gosh, I hope I pronounced your last name right. I call him Steve Z. And he's up in the Seattle area. He is a USPSA Masterclass Shooter. United States Practical Shooting Association, another competition league you definitely might want to check out in your area. He's a master class shooter. He's pretty accomplished. And it was great. We had a chance to talk to each other on Skype, and I recorded it, and it came off great. It's an excellent interview. So we're going to talk about competition shooting, and we're going to talk a little bit about combat shooting and low light shooting and so forth. And he's going to share with you some excellent techniques that he uses to become a better shooter out there on the range and in competition. And you know, somebody posted a great article on the Gun Rights Radio Network forum that was also written by Randy Harris about the benefits of learning to be a good competitive shooter. And it's very well done. Steve talks a lot about that today. And, you know, really accuracy and speed win any kind of a fight. When it all boils down to it, you know, I've never been in a gunfight, and I hope I never am. All right? But in talking to people who have been, mostly law enforcement people, they always claim it comes down to speed and accuracy. It doesn't last very long. It lasts mere seconds, and it comes down to speed and accuracy. Whoever can shoot the best and shoot the fastest wins the darn thing. And again, I hate even talking about this because even though I carry a gun every single day, every day I am armed at home and when I go out of my house. I hope I never have to use it. But I will train and train and prepare for that day if it does come, because I gotta tell you folks, I want to live. And I've said it many times and I'll say it again. That's why I carry a gun. I carry a gun because I want to live. I don't carry a gun because I'm looking for trouble. I carry a gun because trouble sometimes finds me. And it found me once. Trouble found me once. And fortunately, gunshots were not involved, and I was not hurt. Thank God. But you know what? I was not prepared. I did not have a weapon on me that day, about 5.5, almost 6 years ago now, when trouble found me. And that's what motivated me to get into the shooting sports, into concealed carry. And as I've mentioned on this show in the past, I've shared with you some listener feedback of what got people involved and interested in concealed carry. So, with that said, I think I've rambled on enough about that. I want to knock out a couple of announcements because you're not going to hear me come back on after the interview is over. This is a great interview. I can't say it any better, and I don't really have any comments because Steve did a fabulous job with this interview. You're going to learn a lot. So when it's over, You're just going to hear music, and the show will close out. And then I'll be talking to you again Wednesday or Thursday of this week with my synopsis from the Suarez International class. So here we go. Give me a minute's worth of announcements, and I'll cut to the interview. I can't do a show without talking about the Freedom Raffle, which is closely coming to an end. There is a chance, and I'll let you know by Wednesday or Thursday, I may extend it a little bit. I'm still playing around with that idea because some people are mailing in their payments instead of paying online, which is okay. Win a Ruger LCP, win possibly a couple of $100 gift certificates to CompTech Holsters or KnivesAndGear.com and get yourself a new knife. $100 gift certificate there too. Proceeds are supporting this show, supporting the Gun Rights Radio Network and the Second Amendment Foundation if they happen to win the poll. If you send me money, folks, go to the Gun Rights Radio Network forum, go to the Handgun World section, and I have a thread there called Where Should I Send the Money? Vote! Let your voice be heard. The majority is going to win, and that entity will be the benefactor of the Freedom Raffle. Please do me a favor. If you pay online, don't put the word raffle in the comments. Just put the word freedom or leave it blank. I will know what it's about. Okay, and don't forget about my YouTube channel, and you can also share all my podcasts and posts and everything on Facebook or Twitter. Just go to the share tab at the bottom of every post, at the bottom of the show notes. For every podcast that I do, it says share right there. And if you want to go ahead and tweet this, or if you want to put it on Facebook, please do. Also, check out the Gun Rights Radio Network Facebook page as well. Good stuff. All right, that's it. I don't like to make this show real commercial. That's just not my style. You tune in for content, so content is what you're going to get. Here you go. This is my interview with Steve Z. That's what I call him. Zopfi, I think, is his last name. Again, Steve, I'm sorry if I screwed that up. He's a loyal listener to the show, a terrific shooter, and he's analyzed this stuff so well that I think you're going to appreciate this. Here's the interview, folks, and I will catch you again in a couple of days. Enjoy.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Hey, you're there.
Yeah.
All right. That was weird. All of a sudden, I hear somebody on the line. I'm like,
like what?
That's strange. That's good. Yeah, how was your match?
It actually went pretty good. I ended up finishing third in production, which, all things considered, using the Glock 19 is not too bad considering the guys that I'm shooting against are using like Glock 34s. Apparently there's also a new pistol out called by Tenfoglio, which apparently is going to be the hot gun in production now. So one of the local grandmasters is testing that out and doing some work on it and feedback and whatnot. So he ended up actually finishing second. I ended up finishing third, about 6% down to him. So I thought it went pretty good. But it was interesting because we had a very, very large combination of point shooting stages during the match. It was kind of interesting. So
how timely.
Very, yeah, no kidding. That's what I thought.
How timely. Well, you know what? Tell me about this Tenfoglio pistol now. Okay, so you're there shooting your Glock 19, and there's some other pistol for production that's hot now? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's interesting because I, to be honest, I don't follow the guns in production so much as I do for limited, because that's my main division that I typically shoot. But in production, I guess the really hot gun used to be the CZ SP-01 or something like that, and a lot of guys were gravitating toward that.
Right.
And then Tenfoglio came out with something here very new, extremely new, that I guess is going to eclipse the SP-01 in terms of being a competitive gun. And obviously, you know, the intent of production is that you can't really go off and trick the gun out, but the gun already apparently comes fairly tricked out from the factory, so therefore it's a production gun.
Interesting.
Yeah, but the guys are going off and they said that it's set up very well to shoot competitively, but the only thing that really is missing at this point is the trigger. because they want to get the triggers down to like a pound or a pound. Well, I should probably say a pound and a half or probably sub 2 pounds.
Wow.
But there's nobody out there right now in the industry actually producing a sub 2 pound trigger. So everybody's kind of off on their own at this point. And it's only a matter of time. I mean, eventually, you know, the industry will catch up with the demand and you'll see somebody out there offering a, you know, a competitive trigger for, the guns. The interesting thing about production is that you can do internal trigger work. None of the modifications can be externally visible from, you know, from outside the gun to give it any indication.
Right.
So people will go off and do a lot of trick stuff on the insides of their gun, which are all legal under USPSA rules.
Right.
And I guess that's one of the things that they're looking at doing here with the 10 Foglio. So I really don't know a whole lot about the gun because I don't follow the production guns that close. One of my friends actually who is a A-class shooter shooting a Glock 34 actually ended up beating the guy who's a grandmaster, which was rather surprising. I think it's
nice.
The first time that he's done it. And yeah, really. And it's funny because I've shot with my friend a lot who's shooting the Glock 34. And in fact, we all kind of formed a pact at the beginning of the year that we were all going to shoot our Glock 19s for the entire year. So that, you know, not only, because we pretty much figured, okay, we're all going to suck. We're all shooting Glock 19s, but we'll all be shooting against each other. So there'll at least be some competitive, you know, nature and all this. And of course, they did that for a couple matches and got fed up with the Glock 19 and then went back to all their competitive guns.
Well, now they should have been, they should have been more patient because there's
know,
a lot
yeah,
of people,
yeah.
a lot of people can do some pretty amazing things with a Glock 19. That's for sure.
And the thing is that with anything, I think, you know, this happens a lot. And I kind of learned this myself when I started learning how to shoot with both eyes open and also started learning how to use a target focus. But you got to realize that in the beginning, you're going to go backwards. You're not going to go, it's not going to be an immediate jump forward. You're going to actually go backwards before you go forwards. And it's a matter
Absolutely.
Of really teaching your brain or reprogramming your brain of what we're doing, what this is all about, and getting it to learn. And then after it learns, you can go forward. But, you know, when I started learning how to shoot with both eyes open, I said, okay, I know I'm going to suck. I'm going to be doing really bad. I'm going to be missing the target, and it's just a matter of part of the learning process. And then eventually, after a while, after you get it, you know, it's a huge step forward, but it's a matter of definitely realizing that you're going to go backwards before you go forwards. And I think a lot of people will get impatient because they're looking for an immediate result, and they do something, and,
right.
and then they go, okay, this isn't working, and they dismiss it where, you know, you need to stick with it and work through it. So,
well, yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, you mentioned shooting with both eyes open. And I've actually, I got the recorder on. I'm recording this now.
Okay.
And what, I'm glad you said that because I've always done that. In fact, I cannot shoot with just one eye, open and the other eye closed. From the very first time I picked up a pistol,
mm-hmm.
I started shooting both eyes open because somebody who I think, and I think it was in USPSA at that time because I was in Oklahoma City and there was no IDPA clubs.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was. It was. The guy was a grandmaster and he said, look, now he said, don't close one eye. Keep both eyes open.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point because I, from my standpoint, I decided I was going to learn the technique of shooting with both eyes open. But to be honest, when it comes to shooting, I see what I need to see. And there are some times that I'm shooting with both eyes open. There are some times that I will reduce the vision in my weak eye slightly. And there's other times where I will completely shut my left eye. And it really depends on the difficulty of the shot,
right.
What's around the target. If you have a hard cover or no shoot, you know, bordering the target, or if you're trying to shoot something at 50 yards. I mean, at 50 yards, not only do I have my left eye shut and I'm seeing the front sight, but I'm extremely focused on what the trigger feels like.
Sure.
And I mean,
sure.
just getting the sights aligned is the easy part. The trick is learning how to break the shot and not, you know, jerk the trigger or anything like that. But it's interesting because a lot of people get into this fallacy of thinking that the only way I'm going to get good or the only way I'm going to win is to shoot with both eyes open. And there are actually a lot of top level shooters. And one I'll mention, Brian Enos.
Oh, yeah.
Who for years, and even to this day, you know, has mentioned that this whole entire, you know, focus on, or I shouldn't say focus, it's probably a bad word, but attraction, whatever you want to call it, to thinking that you have to shoot with both eyes open to get good is incorrect. He shot for years, I mean, forever, with one eye shut. And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we obviously know how well that Brian Enos has done.
Yeah, he's very good.
Yeah, you know, back in the day. So I think this whole entire thing about saying, oh, you know, you have to shoot with both eyes open is not true. I learned it as just, you know, another trick in the bag that I can apply. And the beauty of both eyes open is that you have more of a 3D perspective. Things are not so two-dimensional that you can really, you know, you open your vision up and you can see a whole lot more. But in terms of when to shoot that way or when I, you know, it really depends on the difficulty of the shot. And to be honest, I don't think about it. I don't have to sit there and think, okay, well, here I can go both those open and here I need to, you know, restrict my vision or whatever. It could be from just, you know, years of shooting or lots of dry fire practice or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
That my mind has just figured out what it needs to do when it needs to do it, and it does it without me actually having to think about what I want to do.
And that's a very good point. Thanks for bringing that up. In fact, that's part of why we wanted to get this call together, was to talk about doing what you have to do, point shooting versus sighted shooting and things. But I like what you said. You and you've mentioned this on the forum before. I think you've posted this or you've sent me a private email saying that your mind sees what it needs to see.
Explain that. Well, okay, so in terms of shooting, you have a conscious awareness and a subconscious awareness. And you were mentioning before about the, you know, the argument or whatever between a target focus and then point shooting, and then asking the question, you know, is it one or the other or is it both?
Yeah.
And I think the answer, I think, for everybody is it's both, but they don't realize it. And what I mean by that is that for in usually in competition circles or whatever, we refer to it as either, you know, a front sight aware or front sight focus. And then the other focus that we typically refer to is a target focus. And target focus is just another name for point shooting, to be honest. But the thing with a target focus is that what you're doing there is you're looking through the sights. And in the process of looking through the sights, your conscious awareness may not be on the front sight, but your subconscious awareness definitely is picking up everything that's happening. And your subconscious can actually process, you know, multiple tasks or multiple events at a given time, where your conscious awareness can only pick out one thing and only do it.
That's
so
interesting.
What happens is that your subconscious there, and I've noticed this when I'm shooting, and it's often referred to as being in the zone. You'll hear people say, you know, you're in the zone or whatever, and you kind of brush it off as like, okay, yeah, whatever.
Hey, but whatever.
But the whole entire thing about being in the zone, I mean, I've been there a couple times, and there are some people who can literally put themselves into the zone when it comes to shooting, and people like that are like, you know, Travis Tomasi and guys like that, or Max Michelle or whatever, who are at the top of their game.
Bruce
Gray.
But
the thing there is that when you are shooting, it's weird because it's like time slows down and you literally see everything. You'll see, when I'm shooting, I've seen like what I can just see, it looks like a brass hose out the side of your gun. I just see like cases flying out in my peripheral vision. It's really weird. But the thing is that in terms of point shooting, you're focused on the target, but your mind, whether you realize it or not, is picking up the sights or picking up the slide and using that as an index. So your mind really actually is using the sights. And the guys who say, well, I'm point shooting and I'm not using the sights, I think really actually are using the sights. They don't realize that they're actually using it, though.
Yeah.
And the flip side of that is that the guys who sit there and say, okay, well, I'm a hard front sight focus guy, and I don't point shoot. When, I don't know if you've ever noticed it, but whenever you do either shooting on the move or if you've ever shot like a moving target, like the Bianchi mover or something like that, in order to shoot I'll admit up front, I've not shot Bianchi, but I have shot movers before. To shoot a target like that, or if you're doing lateral movement across the stage and trying to shoot a target, your awareness goes to the target. I don't think there's actually any way that you could focus on your front sight and move laterally or, you know, across a stage or focus on your front sight and try to track a mover. And I think if anybody who's been around the shotgun sports after a while realizes that the way that you hit clay targets is that you don't focus on the beads, you focus on the target, and your subconscious mind picks up the bead on the shotgun, and it knows where to put it. It knows that the barrel are in the vicinity of the target that you're shooting at. And I think the same thing happens when you are either shooting in the move or in point shooting or whatever, is that your subconscious mind is processing all this data. It sees basically what it needs to see, and whether you realize it or not, it is correcting everything for you, and putting, you know, the sights or the gun on the target. And as long as you do a nice clean trigger break, you know, it's taking care of itself.
Well, you're exactly right. And see, I have a terminology for that. I call that the unconscious competent.
Right.
And, you know, I've talked about that before, the five steps in the learning process, and it applies to anything. It applies to shooting. You know, and when you're that good, when you're at the when you're at the level where all you have to do is focus on the target and you thrust that gun towards a target and your barrel is pointing where it should be, you're putting rounds on target, you're really not even looking at the sights, I would say you're probably unconscious competent by then. Wouldn't you agree?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, definitely at that point. It's really funny because, you know, it's Yogi Berra, who is one of my, you know, favorite baseball players, to put one of his favorite comments that he's made in terms of shooting is that, you know, 90% of shooting is mental and the other half is physical.
Right.
But I really honestly believe it, that when you get up to that stage in the game, I mean, when you're first starting out, you're having to literally think about everything you do. You think about the trigger pull. You think
right.
about putting the front sight on the target, and you think about all that stuff. But after you've done it for a long time, you programmed your mind, and your mind literally just starts, you know, running the program for you, and you don't really have to think about it too much. And the whole entire thing kind of gets into the zen of shooting. And I don't know if you've read the book by Brian Enos or not, which it's Practical Shooting Beyond Fundamentals. But
I'd like to read that too.
Definitely read it. That book is a head trip.
Would you say that again? What's the title of it?
Brian Enos wrote a book years ago, I think it was back in the 80s, called Practical Shooting Beyond Fundamentals.
Practical Shooting Beyond Fundamentals, okay.
And it's sometimes been referred to as the Zen of Practical Shooting. And it's it's received that nickname for a very good reason. The first time I read the book, I was completely confused about what he was saying. I was like reading this going, I have no clue what you're talking about. And the second time I read the book, it's kind of like, okay, this is kind of weird. The third time I read the book, I was kind of beginning to understand what he was saying. The fourth time I read the book, I was kind of, you know, really beginning to comprehend the concepts. And the fifth time I read the book, I actually understood everything that he was saying. I literally had to read the book five times to the point that I actually understood. And I think that's one of the things with when you start talking about the mind and, you know, psychological stuff, and clearly I'm not a psych major or anything. I'm a software engineer, so.
Well, I'm not a psych major either. I'm just a salesperson. That's all.
Yeah. But I mean, you read this stuff and it really, I mean, it's out there, but it turns out to be true. I mean, the whole entire thing about shooting, it's all mental. It's all what your mind sees and all the rest of it's just mechanics, and anybody can do the mechanics. But when you get to that, you know, next level of shooting, I think it really starts becoming a focus on the mind, so to speak, of what it sees, what it does, how it processes things. I mean, years ago, I suffered from a really bad problem of a trigger jerk. It wasn't a flinch problem. At first I thought it was a flinch problem. I started doing the math, literally trigonometry. And I'm going, okay, well, wow. If it was, you know, I was looking, figuring out angles and distance of targets and all this stuff, and go, okay, well, if it was a true flinch problem, it would be so many degrees, which would mean I was shooting like below the target. And I'm not shooting below the target, I'm hitting the target, but I'm low on the target. So what is causing that? And I found a book that has since been renamed, but it was called Freedom from Trigger Jerk. And I think they renamed it The Mental Mechanics of Shooting or something like that. But it was real. I mean, it was definitely a book about the mind, but it was written in a perspective that you could actually understand what he was saying. And the problem with trigger jerk is that your mind kind of gets impatient with this whole entire thing about putting the front sight on the target. And it's kind of like, okay, fine, the front sight's on the target. Let's just get over with it and get moving. So what happens is that
let's get on with it.
Yeah, basically. So the front sight gets on the target, and your mind goes, okay, I did what you want me to do, so let's go. So what it does is it says, okay, the front sight's on the target. Hit the trigger now. Let's get out of here and go on to the next target. And it's that whole entire problem of, okay, hit the trigger now, which causes trigger jerk. When you slam a trigger like that, I mean, more often than not, you will pull the gun down, and you
That's
end up
exactly
with, you know,
right.
bad trigger control. So I read that book, and I realized, okay, what's going on, and they mentioned, you know, the way to get through a lot of this stuff was to do lots of repetitive dry firing, and that's really how I started out. So I started doing a lot of dry firing, and then I would go to the range and reinforce it with live fire, and to the point that I actually realized, you know, I finally broke through the whole entire trigger jerk problem, and then you go into the next problem, whatever that may be, so.
Well, there's not much substitute for that dry fire practice, is there?
No, there isn't. I mean, honestly speaking, I do probably about dry fire, about 20 minutes of dry fire no more than 20 minutes, probably about 3 or 4 times a week. And if you start going, so the problem with dry fire or people get into is they don't treat dry fire as if they're out in the range. They're just going, you know, okay, fine, I'm dry firing and I'm putting my my front sight on a spot in the wall or whatever, and I'm pulling the trigger and blah, blah, blah. But the thing is that they really need to treat what they're seeing in dry fire the same way as if they were shooting a stage. So the idea is don't accept anything less than an A-zone hit when you're dry firing.
That's a very good point. Very good
point. Yeah, because what you do in dry fire practice is going to translate over into your live fire. And if you have poor mechanics or poor discipline doing dry fire, you're going to have the same problem in your live fire practice.
Yeah. Now, you know what? Let me stop you there for a minute, Steve. For the people listening to this that are not real familiar with competition, what he's talking about when he says the A-zone, he's basically talking about the same thing that IDPA shooters call the zero-down zone. And basically, that's the center of the target. That's the center of the center of mass. That's where you want to put everything in the A zone. Correct?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the A zone scores the most points in USPSA. Whether you're shooting minor or major power factor, it's 5 points.
Right.
And IDPA, it's a down zero circle or whatever.
Which means they're not adding any seconds or points to your time, right?
Right, right.
So
yeah.
And the A zone typically on a USPSA target is either in the head or it's in the center of mass, correct?
Yeah, or what they like to call now the upper scoring panel, because the head got a lot of bad.
the
politically correct or whatever. Yeah, I know. So
I guess down here in Texas, an IDPA.
It's the head.
It's a headshot. I mean, come on, give me a break to all the gun haters out there.
I only threw that in there because of that, just a joke. I mean, years ago, so you know, they tried to get away from. In fact, in IPSC worldwide, they changed the target to be what we refer to as the amoeba target or the turtle target or whatever, which basically has no head zone. And they tried to make it look like a non, you know, humanoid type target. And in the U.S., we still have what's referred to as the metric target, which is kind of odd because our target is the metric target and their target is the classic target, but our target has been around before their target. So which one's the classic target? I don't know.
Well,
but anyway,
now that's completely ridiculous. If they ever do that here, I'm going to quit the shooting sports because you got to have a headshot. I mean,
well, the thing that you got in IDPA, I shouldn't say that. I mean, it is not just U.S. U.S. sport. It has been done in other countries and whatnot. But
that's true.
At any rate, and they have pushed this idea around in the U.S. a couple times of adopting the classic target or the turtle target or whatever to make the sport more palatable to, you know, people or whatnot. But on the other hand, we're shooting guns. It is what it is. You're not going to make it palatable
we're shooting guns with live ammo, folks. What do they expect?
and we're out there doing what we're doing and, you know, yes, it is a game, but its background is in, you know, combat pistol technique. Jeff Cooper, you know, really is the founding father of it back in the day, so.
That's right. Well, if I can change the subject just a little bit,
sure.
Steve, if you don't mind. You have inspired me to do the same thing, and I've mentioned this many times, that I'm borrowing this idea from you, to stick with my Glock 19 for an entire year. So my Glock 34 has become a safe. It's keeping my safe nice and warm, while I actually have 2 Glock 19s, and both of them are now what I'm using. Tell me what's your reasoning behind that?
Well, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned that because whenever I would go to the range, I would always take out I have a STI limited gun that's fairly tricked out for shooting USPSA limited.
Okay.
And every time I would go to the range, I would like, well, I'm out to practice, and since I'm going to practice, I should be shooting what I practice, you know, basically the biggest bang for the buck, so to speak. So I'd haul out the STI, and I'd do it over and over and over. And I would always kind of say, you know, someday I ought to take the Glock 19 out, which is my carry gun. It's also my house gun. It's what I use for everything.
Right.
But at any rate, it's what I, you know, defend my life with if it got down to that point. But I always say, well, you know, I'm going to take it out someday, but I would be like, well, I'll practice, I'm going to go out to the range, I'm going to grab the STI. And I would keep on doing that over and over and over. And I realized that until I would actually force myself to shoot the Glock 19 that I, you know, I would get lazy or just come up with an excuse and not do it because I was trying to be competitive. So this year, I decided, okay, fine. I'm going to force myself to shoot the Glock 19, and I'm going to shoot it for the entire. So I started shooting, and again, up at this point, my only experience in shooting my Glock 19 was like every once in a while I'd maybe, you know, go out to the range, fire a few rounds, and then haul up the STI and shoot it. I wasn't getting a whole lot of trigger time in the Glock 19, so I decided, okay, I'm going to start shooting the Glock 19 for the entire year. And to add to that, I ended up taking a advanced handgun class at Firearms Academy of Seattle. And again, took my Glock 19 down for that, which was a very enlightening experience. I'm really actually glad I did that. It was a good deal. So the point with the Glock 19 was learning how to manipulate the trigger, because that's the one, you know, problem, you know, with, I would say, anybody who transitions from a 1911 to a Glock is that with a 1911, you're used to a fairly light trigger. And my STI has a sub-2-pound trigger. I go to a Glock with, and my Glock is completely stock. I have not done anything to it for shooting USPSA. So it is what it is, and it's exactly the way it would normally be for a carry. You know, I get people saying, well, what about lightning springs? They're putting one of those Wolf heavy-duty return springs on. It's like, no, I'm not going to do that because it's my carry gun, and I don't want to do anything that's going to compromise, you know, the reliability of the gun. So it's exactly stock. The only thing that I've done is I've replaced the front sight with a Dawson fiber optic, and the reason I did that, again, gets back into familiarization. On my STI, I've got a fiber optic on it. So I thought, well, since I'm used to seeing a fiber optic from my front sight, I should put one on my carry gun, too.
Might as well stick with that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It makes sense. And then in terms of the rear sight, I ended up putting on an Ameriglow black serrated fairly wide notch rear sight. So I'm not a big believer in night sights and just keep it simple, basically, so...
Yeah, well, me too. People have heard me talk about black-on-black sights, you know, because that's how I learned shooting. I learned shooting with a black front sight and black rear sight, you know, black-on-black.
Right.
That's how I learned.
I did the same thing. I started out with black-on-black, and then you started hearing all this stuff, and this was back in the early 90s about fiber optic, and I thought, wow, that sounds pretty cool. So I went off and got a fiber optic front sight. And the funny thing is that a lot of people think that the fiber optic is used for aiming the gun, and it's not. The fiber optic, the only point of a fiber optic is to allow you to quickly find the front sight on transitions.
Exactly.
You transition hard, you transition fast, you see the front sight, but if you need that hard front sight focus, you go to the top of the front sight or look, you know, and use a traditional, you know, sight focus. But a lot of people, I think, get hung up on fiber optics thinking that it's a way to aim the gun, and it's not. It's just a mechanism for finding the front sight.
Very good point. So how's it working out with your Glock 19?
It's getting better. I finally got through the point after a few matches of learning how to manipulate the trigger reset, which, you know, and the funny thing with that is that I was consciously trying to think about how to manipulate the trigger. I was sitting there, I was thinking, okay, you know, break, reset, and it was really choppy, and my shooting was horrid. I was actually, you know, jerking the trigger because I was thinking, okay, I'm right there, okay, hit it now, and I would hit it, and I would jerk the gun down. And finally, I just said, you know what, my subconscious mind is going to figure this out, so I'm just going to let it figure it out, and it did. It finally, it ended up, I mean, again, doing a lot of dry fire practice.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, but I mean, I ended up doing a lot of dry fire and then went to the range, and my subconscious must have picked it up or whatever, and now I'm no longer jerking the trigger. I'm getting the reset down. I've been playing a little bit with my grip on trying to prevent the gun from pulling to the left, trying to figure out where to get my finger on the trigger to prevent that.
Right.
And whatnot. In fact, today I tried an experiment of... I also shoot with the traditional thumbs forward grip, and I found this, but if I typically ride the slide really close with both thumbs, and my strong hand shooting thumb, and I'm right-handed, was typically riding right on the slide lock, which consequently when the gun would go dry, it wouldn't lock the slide back, but that's not the end of the world.
I had the same problem.
Yeah. So what I did is, as an experiment, I just moved my thumb, my strong hand thumb, slightly to the left and off the slide. And it reduces the tension on the gun, because I found that with my thumb tight down the side of the gun in speed shooting, that the natural tendency for whatever, probably because of my grip or just tension or whatever, is that it slightly pulled the gun to the left. And when I was trying to fire quickly, that second follow-up shot sometimes would go to the left. So I've now found that just by slightly moving my thumb to the left, off the slide, that it is probably reducing torque on the back of the gun, and now I'm finding that for speed shooting, I'm shooting straight again. So,
well, now, well, wait a minute, hold on now. Okay, you haven't said anything about the lousy grip angle of the Glock.
No, there's no problem with that.
I'm so glad you said that. And
I
know I'm going to get flamed for saying that.
No. I think that's just a poor excuse by a lot of people saying, well, I can't shoot a Glock because of the grip angle or whatever. I shot a 1911. I've shot it for years, but I started shooting competitively in USPSA in 92 or 93, and I was shooting a 1911 then. And then 3 years ago, when the assault weapons ban got flipped, I decided, well, this is a good time to go off and gear up for limited because I can now get magazines, and I may not be able to get magazines again at a reasonable price. So I switched over to shooting limited. But still, the grip angle on my STI is the same as it is in a 1911. So I've been shooting for years and years and years with a traditional, 1911 grip angle. And when I switched to the Glock, did some dry fire practice for a few weeks, whatever, went to the range, no problem whatsoever. So
now, I just want everybody to know that's listening to this, I did not set this up. Steve didn't even know I was going to talk about this. So his answer is straight from the heart.
Yeah, no, I really think it's, I get a kick out of the people who comment about how the Glock grip angle is so different or whatever that it's going to cause you to shoot high. And, it does. Yeah. Is that what it is?
Well, yeah. I analyzed it in a couple of podcasts ago. I pulled up some information, and it's 4 degrees different than a 1911.
Really? Okay.
That's it, 4 degrees. And that's not that much. I mean, maybe if you're point shooting at 25 yards, which go figure, who would actually be point shooting at 25 yards? But
I wouldn't.
I wouldn't either. Then maybe 4 degrees is going to be a difference, but it's not.
And this is another one of those things where your subconscious will figure it out for you. And after a bunch of draw strokes, let's say there is a difference. Well, obviously there is a difference, but let's say, that you start out and you draw and you're looking up the slide. I hear that comment a lot from people who just transitioned from a 1911 to a Glock is, I draw the gun, I look at it, and I'm looking up the slide. The front sight's high or whatever. And if you do a bunch of, dry fire repetitive practice, and you hear the term muscle memory, well, there's no such thing as muscle memory because your muscles don't have memory at all.
Well, that's true.
Right.
I use that term a lot, though.
I know a lot of people use that term. But what the whole entire thing is the repetitive training or repetitive, process where you're teaching your mind a task over and over and over, and your mind then knows what to do with the muscles or whatever. The structure to accomplish the end goal. So, you start out and you're looking at the slide, on a Glock and you draw a bunch of times. And after, a couple, maybe 100, whatever draw strokes initially or eventually you'll start pulling the front sight down and everything will line up. So, it'll be interesting when I switch back to my STI and when I start shooting it again am I going to be shooting into the ground? I don't think so. It's probably just taking a little bit of, draw fire or dry fire practice or whatever with a thing, and I'll be right back to where I was before. It's just, like the old deal about riding a bike. You go out and you ride a bike, and it doesn't mean you're going to go off and get back in a bike after 20 years and go crash on the ground the first time you get out there or fall off the thing. You figure it out. So.
Oh, what a great point that is. You're right. You do figure it out. And actually, I think it's probably a good idea if people train with both types, Glock M&P XD type of a gun and a 1911 style gun, because in that way, it's probably like riding a bike. Unless you abandon a certain type for 15, 20 years, you're going to pick it right back up again.
Yeah, and I've heard comments from people that say, you should learn to shoot any gun that you pick up or whatever, because you never know, this probably more applies to people who are on the battlefield or whatever, but you never know in a given situation.
You never know what you're going to find.
Exactly. Yeah, you don't know what you're going to find or what you're going to come across, and you should be proficient with anything. And that may be true.
For civilian use, I don't know if that's really all that realistic.
Yeah, Yeah.
A civilian in a self-defense situation, I don't think it's going to be finding somebody else's gun, really.
Probably not. Probably not.
Have to pick it up and use it. That's not likely. I'm not saying it's not possible. It's just not likely, I don't think.
Right. It's probably not a very – I guess, yes, it could possibly happen, but the likelihood of it happening things would have to get to a pretty sorry state for that to have to happen.
Yeah, I mean, nothing wrong with learning to shoot different types of patterns of guns, but if there's one you feel comfortable with, if you're comfortable with 1911s, if you're comfortable with striker-fired guns, if you're comfortable with revolvers, then stick with that and practice and train hard with that, and I think you'll be fine. I happen to believe that shooting is shooting. If you can shoot well, you can pick up almost anything and shoot it well.
And learn to shoot it. Yeah, that's true.
And learn
to
shoot it. You know,
very
true. And you could take that. You could take that piece of junk plastic Glock 19, and you can put that in the hands of Rob Lethem, and he'll probably do okay with it.
Yeah, Rob's a pretty amazing guy. I've shot with him before.
I have not. That'd be cool.
Really? Yeah. No. I ended up shooting a match called the Western State Single Stack Championship, which is a match that Steve Horstman puts on. In fact, if any of your listeners are listening or are interested in shooting 1911s, this is a single stack match. It's run at the Rio Salado Range in January, every year. And the match has just grown to a phenomenal size. But at any rate, years ago, I ended up getting to shoot with Robbie and Kippy. And a bunch of the other hotshot grandmasters down there. So at any rate, I was lucky that I finished in the top 16 in the match, and they decided at the end to have a shoot-off.
Oh, wow, really?
Man-on-man steel shoot-off, and guess who I got drawn to shoot against?
Rob Lee.
Yeah, you want to talk about intimidation. I mean, I immediately knew I was screwed at that point, but I thought, what the hell? I mean, you know.
Well, how did you do? Tell us.
Well, he beat me, obviously.
Of course, yeah, I know, but did you hold your own?
I did all right. I mean, you're also standing there in the box going, oh my God, I'm shooting against Rob Lethem. But to be honest, you know, I mean, it's like, okay. But at that point, I was having fun with it. I was like, okay, I'm shooting against Rob Lethem. There's no expectations at this point, obviously. So, I mean, yeah, he ended up beating me by probably a couple steel targets or whatever. I think it was like 8 steel targets and the traditional steel popper where you have to, like, you know, the first one that drops or whatever and they overlap each other and whatnot. So, but I will say the one advantage that I had, and you had to do a reload. I had a broken right thumb and
oh, really?
I had to change my whole entire technique of doing reload because I couldn't manipulate my right thumb, so I had to do a reload using my left thumb, hitting the mag release, pulling the mag out of the gun, then going down, grabbing a mag, and coming up.
Interesting.
So it's one of those things, you do what you gotta do. I mean, you end up having, you know, a handicap, and you need to adapt to it, and unfortunately I ended up breaking my thumb 3 weeks before the match, and I thought, well, I gotta come up with a new technique, and I need to make a technique fast that's gonna work, and I saw, actually I saw a video of Julie Golovsky, or Julie Golub now, and that's how she does her reloads. She does her reloads, with the weak hand and hits the mag release and strips the magazine or literally pulls the magazine out of the gun. I thought, okay, well, that's one technique. Let me see if I can adopt that. And, I started doing that and I shot the whole entire match that way. So.
Wait a minute. I don't understand something. Okay. So you hit the magazine release with your weak hand thumb, but if you have a drop free mag, doesn't it come flying out of the gun?
Well, it should, but the thing is that you have basically in a normal traditional grip at this point, you've got two hands on the gun. And normally, for a normal normal release, you take, you know, your one hand goes away from the gun, your other hand or your strong hand thumb is hitting the release as your hand's coming down for your fresh magazine and then you're coming up. Well, in this case here, what I had to do is I had both hands on the gun and as my weak hand, this is kind of hard to describe it, as my weak hand is coming down, I'm literally coming down from my normal full firing grip, hitting the mag release. But the thing is that your hand is pretty much underneath the gun at this point.
I see. Yeah. I've been sitting here trying it while you're explaining it. Now I see what you're talking about.
Yeah, it does work. I mean, it's a useful technique to learn how to do. And just in case you end up breaking your right thumb for an important match.
Well, it's important to learn to adapt because, you know, We hate to think about this, but we all train in case we happen to be in some type of a fight. And you never know what could get disabled if you're
right.
in a fight.
Yeah, many of my friends were suggesting that I shoot weak hand only for weeks until my thumb healed. And I was like, nah, I'm not going to do that. I mean, as much as that would probably be a very good learning experience to shoot weak hand only in all my USPSA matches or whatever for many, many weeks, I just thought I'm going to try to see if I can't work around this thing. And I was able to do that, so.
Well, I'll tell you what happened, and, you know, most of the listeners, including you, you're going to hear about this before our interview actually hits the air, but just last Thursday night, I was in a low-light IDPA match. And so I'm holding a flashlight with my weak hand, and I'm shooting. I shot the whole entire match basically strong hand only because I was using the other hand for my flashlight.
Right, right.
And that was great practice. That was great practice shooting an entire match strong hand only. Now, you know, shooting it weak hand only, that'd be kind of an experience doing it weak hand only, but that would be good practice.
It would be, and it's one of those things where, I mean, you need to go out there and do that. However, I don't know if I'd want to do it for, you know, 6 weeks or whatever the case.
No. Maybe two stages, actually. A couple of stages.
When you're shooting with a flashlight, and I don't remember all the techniques and all the names and all that stuff, but you can probably just describe to me what technique you use. So how are you holding the flashlight? Are you doing, I think they used to call it the FBI method, where you held the thing, like, you know, 2 feet away from your body, or are you doing the thing where you kind of wrap the gun around underneath your strong hand, or are you doing the syringe technique or whatever? Which one are you doing?
I don't know what it's called, but I hold the flashlight in my weak hand, and I bring my weak hand wrist underneath my strong hand. So I've got a full extension with my strong hand, a complete, you know, arms locked and extension.
Right.
And I bring my weak hand wrist underneath, and I basically rest. I rest the, not the gun, but I rest my wrist of my strong hand on top of my weak hand wrist, and then that way my light is illuminating the target. Now, I was shooting my Glock 19 with my TFO night sights.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have to illuminate my sights. I saw some guys actually using the flashlight, and they were kind of holding it back behind their gun because they were illuminating their sights at the same time.
Right, yeah.
And actually, I had a crappy flashlight. I didn't expect it was going to be a low light, so I had a terrible flashlight, and that was actually a good experience. It was a heck of a learning experience.
Yeah, I can tell you about learning experiences. One of my friends, they have their local IDPA club does kind of an invitation only night shoot because I want to make sure that the people who are doing it are fairly experienced shooters and whatnot. Because the problem, obviously, night shoots is you have the whole entire low light thing and whatnot. But at any rate.
Right.
So he invited me down there to go shoot that thing, and I had never really shot a flashlight before. Again, it's not something that I typically trained with. So I tried the syringe technique or whatever you want to call it, where you hold the thing. Yeah, so I was trying the syringe technique, and the rings of my flashlight were cutting into my finger, and that wasn't all that comfortable. So I thought, okay, well, I'm not going to do that. So I know about the other technique of, you know, holding the flashlight in your weak hand, then wrapping, you know, it under whatever the wrists of, like you were describing. However, I didn't know that it was that you put your strong hand over over the weak hand. You can see where this is going.
Yeah, so I can see where it's going.
I have my weak hand over the top of my strong hand. I'm getting whacked by the slide, and I mean, I'm literally just like just driving the thing into my hand, and I mean, from a positive standpoint, I can tell you that using your hand as a slide stop won't stop a Glock 19 because the thing just kept on running, which I was really impressed with. But at the end of the day, at least I had a nice big gouge in my hand, and I was telling people, okay, this can't be the right technique. This is just not working. And they said, you know, no, you idiot. You stick your hand under the gun. Or, I'm sorry, you stick your, you know, your strong hand, you know, over the flashlight that way. And they showed it. It's like, oh, that's how you do it. So
yeah,
I ended up
I was lucky. I actually had somebody before the match tell me how to do it. Otherwise, I might have done something just like you did, sticking a weak hand over the top of the gun.
It's one way of learning, and like you said, it is a learning experience, and I learned the hard way. And I learned, I mean, because the one good thing is I always thought the syringe technique was, you know, the way to go, and it probably is depending on the flashlight that you use.
What's the syringe technique?
The syringe technique is where you hold the flashlight in your weak hand, kind of as if you were using a syringe, and the flashlight lands between your middle and ring finger or whatever, and then you can then have a full firing grip on your gun or a normal traditional two-handed grip in your gun. The barrel of the flashlight then typically then rides down the grip of the gun, and it ends up being a very stable platform. So you get the advantage of having a two-handed, you know, grip on the gun as opposed to the other technique we were talking about where you're really shooting strong hand only with a little bit of support from your weak hand.
Syringe technique sounds interesting, but then I have a question. You know, during the stages, we had to actually shut the flashlight off when you're moving from one position to another position.
Right.
So if you're using that technique, how would you actually shut your flashlight off?
You need to use a flashlight with a tail cap with a momentary switch, which mine has. So what happens there is you can squeeze the flashlight and the palm of your weak hand, or your weak hand will end up depressing the momentary switch. The light goes on, and then you kind of release the pressure a little bit, and the light goes off, and you can move around, turning it on, turning it off. As opposed to, and I think they actually call it the Harry's method, I believe is what the proper name for it is, but it's sometimes given the name syringe technique. And the other method, and I don't know what it's called, but we'll just call it the wrists over or whatever locked position. You use your weak hand thumb to activate the switch. So you have to have a momentary press switch, for the Harry's method or syringe technique to work properly, because otherwise you're going to be running around with your flashlight on all the time.
Which you don't want to do, which I learned that, and you don't want to be, make yourself a target by
having your flashlight. Yeah, it tends
to light you up. Yeah, it does, and it makes you a target. Well, all right, let's shift gears again.
Mm-hmm.
Competition shooting. Okay, first of all, tell everybody, because a lot of folks don't know, what's your classification in USPSA?
I'm a master in USPSA.
Okay, good. Class. Good. How long have you been doing it?
Since 1990, I think it's 92, so I guess now 18 years.
So you've been around the block a few times.
And I wish I started at a lot younger age than I am right now, because I'm 48, so.
Yeah, we're exactly the same age.
Yeah, yeah.
And I only started a little over 5 years ago. I wish I would have started when I was about 22.
Yeah, same here, same here.
So, all right, so you're far more accomplished than I am, How would you translate, or what parts of the competition sports, shooting sports, would you translate into self-defense? Because there's a huge argument about that. I don't like to get into that argument. That thing actually kind of took a mind of its own after one of my podcasts.
Yeah.
So I
end up actually am one of the instructors for an IPSC 101 class, which is what we call a introductory to IPSC shooting class, which is a 2-day class. Mm-hmm. And when I started shooting IPSC, back in 92 or whatever, I didn't approach it from the standpoint of competition at all. I was using a Colt Commander. I had 7-round magazines. Used an inside the waistband, holster. Mm-hmm. And my intent of shooting IPSC was not for competition. It was to learn to become more proficient with the gun. I wanted to learn how to shoot the gun better. I wanted to learn how to reload better. I wanted to learn how to manipulate the gun better. I mean, just everything that you normally would do. And obviously, I understood that, and IDPA wasn't around back then, but it's really still all the same, that this is not, tactical training. And anything like that, it's not going to teach you tactics. It's not going to teach you how to go, clear a house or whatever it is.
Right.
But it does teach you a lot of the fundamentals, how to draw, how to grip, how to shoot, how to move, how to reload. I mean, how to do a lot of the stuff that can be very beneficial if you need to, need to do that.
Absolutely. And that's why I'm a big proponent of it.
Right. And the thing is that, I mean, up until that point, my shooting was typically done on what we all refer to as a square range. You go off to your, I don't know what your gun ranges look like, but you go off to your gun range and you get yourself a single target and you throw it out there at, 15 yards or whatever you feel like throwing it out at. And you go out there and you shoot and you shoot and you shoot and you're trying to shoot a nice little group, and that's all well and good. But I mean, how often does that come into play? And
never.
I realize it. Yeah. And not unless you can tell the guy, no, wait a minute, go out there and stand at 15 yards and then don't move.
I'm
sure they'll be willing to, to oblige you. But at any rate, so I realized that, I needed to start doing other things. And not only that, but it looked fun. My dogs are barking at somebody. But at any rate, so that's the approach that I took. And that's actually one of the things that I told that a lot of the people that take our IPSC classes of this. It is what you make it. And if you want to be competitive with it, you can be competitive. If you want to look at it from a standpoint of improving your shooting skills, it'll improve your shooting skills. And I operated that way I used 7-round magazines. I pulled them from my back pocket. I didn't use mag carriers because I didn't carry with mag carriers. I ran the gun the way I would have carried it. So,
well, I think that's awesome. I wish more people would do that.
And that's part of my whole entire thing of getting back to the Glock 19 this year was that I, I'm running the gun, so to speak, the way I normally would, if I was carrying. And I originally started out saying I wasn't going to use mag carriers, just like, because I don't, when I carry the Glock 19, I don't use mag carriers. And then one of my friends who's like, oh, just get yourself some mag carriers and whatever. So I go, okay, fine, I'll do that. But I still was using my, my normal carry holster and stuff like that, and still at least being somewhat faithful to, how I'd carry. But at any rate,
yeah, you know, I think I'm going to try that. I think I'm going to try that next time I go to an IDPA. I think I'm going to put my magazines in my back pocket, run it that way, and use my inside the waist holster.
It's easy, to be honest. I've shot a couple IDPA matches, and I with the Glock 19, and I'd always just stuff the magazines in my back pocket, and that's how I did it. And it's no big deal, to be honest. This is the whole entire gaming thing, but you can, like, you know, so to speak, stage your magazines as in angle them to a certain degree, you know, how you think you want to grab them or whatever out of your back pocket. Or just bury them deep and make it like real life. I mean, you know,
exactly.
For a while.
Yeah, but, I mean, I got an email from a listener the other day that I shared on last week's podcast, and he said he was the only guy that showed up at an IDPA match that had his carry gun with him.
Really?
And yeah, he said there were 15 or 16 shooters, and I thought, you know, that's kind of a shame. It really is that you know, he's the only one, and he's a new guy. He was there the first time, so he shows up with his carry gun, which is great. And I thought to myself, isn't that really how IDPA and USPSA both got started? Didn't these leagues get started to teach people or to help people get better with their carry gun?
Yeah, I mean, the whole entire thing, you know, I did see the beginning of IDPA, and when it kind of broke away from USPSA a little bit, but in terms of the very early days of IPSC or whatever, I started out with Jeff Cooper and Southwest Pistol League, I think it was called, and they call it combat pistol shooting. And of course, combat, you know, people are like, oh my God, combat, you guys are out there, you know, doing paramilitary training. So they changed the name of it to make it a little more, you know, acceptable to the public or whatnot. But the intent was, and if you go off and look at the 7 or 8 cornerstone points of USPSA or IPSC or whatever, but it's all about self-defense. It's all about self-defensive use of a handgun,
right.
and a practical nature. And of course, over the years, things have changed just like anything. And you started seeing a little bit of an equipment race, and you have like open division with all the space blasters and stuff like that. But at least in terms of USPSA and IDPA, is that they do have divisions that are there to recognize typical guns that most people have. And USPSA is production, and IDPA, it's stock service pistol.
Correct.
And USPSA, they have what they call single stack division, and IDPA, I think it's custom defensive pistol or something like that.
Right.
But still, you'll see guys come out with semi-tricked out, quote-unquote, production or factory, you know, stuff. And obviously, some guns are better than others. I mean, a Glock 26, the compact Glock, according to stock service pistol, would run heads up against a Glock 34. But are they competitive with each other? No. They're not. But again, it gets back to what the intent is. If your intent is to learn to shoot your carry gun, then you need to be true to, you know, to what you believe in and say, okay, fine, I'm not going to win the match shooting my Glock 26, but I will become more proficient shooting it than if I went off and shot my Glock 34 if you had one or whatever.
Well, yeah, and if somebody's listening to this, if you have something that's subcompact like a Glock 26 or a Smith & Wesson M&P compact, you might want to take that to a backup gun match.
Right. Right.
You know, that's where you can be more competitive, because even though that's still a primary carry gun for a lot of people, it'd be more competitive if you're actually playing the game in a backup gun match.
Right, right.
Because then you're going to compete with all the small pistols.
And unfortunately, and that's I guess the problem with IDPA and the problem with IPSC is that it is competitive. They're scoring the targets. They're putting a time on it, and people, it's a natural tendency. And I'll admit it, I fell into the same thing after shooting, my Colt Commander for 3 years and getting beat by a bunch of people. I finally got the bug and thought, wow, you know, I could, you know, I really want to go out there and start being competitive. And I got a full size 1911 and I got all my, you know, mag carriers and a more racy holster and all that stuff.
Yep.
And it was a horse race. And I mean, it was out of the gate and it went from there. But the thing is, though, with IDP and IPSC is that, yes, it is a game. Yes, people are out there being competitive, and you got to decide whether you're there to be competitive or whether you're there to become more familiar with your stuff. And if you're there to be more familiar with your stuff, then, you know, you got to realize up front that, you know, you're not going to beat everybody, and that's just a fact of life.
Go ahead.
But I was going to say, but the reason that you're there, the intent that you're there is to become familiar and that you're not playing the competition game. You're there for a different reason.
Exactly. And that's kind of how I approach it. You know, I've mentioned many times, I'm not going to be the next Texas State champion or anything like that. And that's not why I'm there. I'm there just to continually try to beat myself, get better each time, and mainly shoot my carry gun.
Right.
The Glock 34, it'll come back out. I'll bring it back out probably after I've put in a full year, and I'll play the game some more, and you know, and try to graduate from being a sharpshooter to an expert shooter, and do that. But for now, it's all about getting better with what I carry.
Right, right, and that, I think that's a really good point. Is that you can go out there and you can be competitive. But then on the other hand, you can learn, you know, what you're doing. And you made a point, and it's true for me, is that every time I go out and shoot, I'm trying to learn something. I'm trying to do something different. I'm trying to learn. I have some goal of something or other. And typically for me recently, my goal is to not have any misses or not have any no-shoots on the matches that I shoot.
Exactly.
And the last two matches I've shot clean. I haven't had any mics or any no-shoots or anything like that. And that's my goal, is to shoot as fast as I possibly can, getting good points. And not having any misses. So every time you go out there and shoot, or at least every time I shoot a match, I typically try to strive for something. And the one thing that typically wins in games is consistency. You want to be consistent in your shooting. You want to be consistent in your manipulation of your gun. And I think not only does that apply to competition, but I think the same thing applies to real life. I mean, you want your equipment to run.
And absolutely.
That's one thing that, you know, you go out there and you shoot, and you will know very quickly if your equipment runs or not, because competition is, I mean, the highest stress on your equipment that you're probably going to find, unless you want to go out and, you know, go to Afghanistan or whatever, which I don't highly recommend very much. But at any rate, competition is probably your best bet for going out there and determining what equipment works, what equipment doesn't work, whether your gun works, what magazine works, what, you know, what your ammo is. I mean, just that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, well, that's a low cost way of doing it. You could go to a 2 or 3 day training class and run it for two. But yes, going to competition, plunking down $15 to a USPSA or an IDPA match is a very inexpensive way to go out there and test your equipment. I 100% am on board with that. And, you know, you brought up something interesting, you know, shooting a clean match. That's been my goal for a long time. And when I went to Texas State, my goal there was, I thought, okay, here I am. I'm at the pressure of a state match. Never done this before. I want to be able to zero out two stages.
Mm-hmm.
And I came pretty damn close. I zeroed out one stage, and the second stage, I was three down on the last target.
Right.
So, you know, that was but even just in non-sanctioned matches, I've actually zeroed out four out of eight stages. So that's
good.
You know, setting goals like that is important, and the speed eventually comes.
Right, and I think that's one of the things, is that people get wrapped up and they see the speed thing and they instantly want to go fast. You know, they'll see somebody else just flying through the stage and they're like, I want to go fast too. But unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. I mean, it's a lot of fundamentals and it's a lot of skills and it's a lot of time and effort, that you need to put into doing that. But
absolutely.
You mentioned something about, you know, that going to a match or whatever is an inexpensive way of learning if your equipment works. And I definitely agree, because there's nothing worse than going and spending a few hundred dollars for a multi-day training class only to get there and just be handcuffed by your equipment not running and being frustrated by that, because, I mean, all of it, you know, you're handicapping yourself because you're not learning, you're fighting your gear and you're slowing things down and you're slowing things down for yourself and probably for everybody else too. So it really becomes a negative thing. So I would really highly recommend that anybody who is taking a training class like that to make sure that they're taking known good working equipment. I mean, don't go out and, you know, if you're shooting a Glock or whatever, don't decide, hey, I'm going to go out and buy some of those Korean magazines, and this is going to be the place where I'm going to go out and test them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. I really didn't think about that. Before you take an expensive training class, get to a dozen IDPA matches or USPSA matches and test your gear out first.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's a good point, Steve. I didn't think about that.
When I went down and shot at the Firearms Academy of Seattle, it's one of the few classes that they allow you to actually shoot your own reloads. A lot of times they require, or a lot of classes require, that you shoot factory stuff. So I brought my own reloads. But I made sure that before I went down there that my reloads were working, and they wouldn't jam and wouldn't cause any problems and stuff like that. So it's this whole entire thing of preparation. I mean, you know, if you're going to spend the money and put the time in, you owe it to yourself to at least make sure that you're knowing good working equipment to those types of classes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I got to tell you, we're pretty much out of time, but I got a feeling we could do a round two on a different subject.
Oh, I'm sure we could. I with anything, I'm more than willing to give my opinion about barely anything. So. Yeah,
well, and thank you. This has been terrific. I got a lot out of this. That's why I love doing these interviews, because I hate being the only one talking, and I hate being the only one injecting any kind of ideas. So this was fantastic. I appreciate you coming on.
Good. Yeah, no problem. It's a give and take thing. I mean, a lot of times, you know, you may say something and I'll pick up on that, and I may say something to you or whatever. So, yeah, it's good. I'm glad.
And you're doing a good job on the forum of chiming in there when necessary and so forth. Thank you.
Well, I think it's actually a really good thing, because the forum things are a good way for people to interact. I mean, I realize that a lot of times they say that. It's like, you know, it's one of the catchphrases or whatever, but it really truly is a good way for people to interact. And I guess one thing I'll throw in here, or the comment, is that for anybody who really is seriously interested in the competitive shooting sports, I mentioned it before, but Brian Enos has his own forum.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay, and if you're not on there, I highly recommend it, because a lot of the heavy hitters that are in the game today, either in USPSA or in IDPA, hang out there, and a lot of times those guys are more than willing to give their opinions or advice on things. So it's a good way to learn stuff and just, you know, be up to speed on a lot of things that are happening.
Well, actually, I am not on there, and I'm probably going to join tomorrow. And I will put a link in the show notes for this podcast where people can go and sign up. But if you don't want to wait for that, just Google Brian Enos Forums, Brian Enos Forums, and you'll see it.
Yeah, really good place to go to just get a lot of information. I've actually learned a lot of things through there. So
I'm going to sign up. Thanks, and
good.
I'll tell them you sent me.
Cool.
Well, as always, thanks for coming on. Thanks for your support. Thanks for everything you do, Steve. And stand by, because after I get done with my close range gunfighting course and podcasting about that, I might invite you on for a part two.
I'd be curious to hear how that's going to go. I think that's really going to be a good class. I really want to hear, you know, how that goes with the point shooting thing. And I would say that when you do that, keep your mind open, and keep your mind open, not so much from the standpoint of keep your mind open to new ideas, but keep your mind open to what you're seeing. And I bet more than anything that when you're shooting point shooting, unless they've got you guys in like or no light, or I mean like taped out your sights or something like that, and you don't have sights, but if you are doing point shooting and looking through your sights, I bet anything, if you go back afterwards and kind of like play the tape in your head a little bit after the fact, you'll see those sights there. Kind of like your mental image that you have, and it's your subconscious picking up on what you have. So
yeah, well, and I'll be sharing some ideas with that. Matter of fact, by the time everybody hears this show here, I will have already taken that course. So you guys will have to wait a week to get some of my thoughts on that. But I'm actually going to try to interview some people while I'm there as well.
Good, good. And next one we can talk about some of the time is calling your shots, because that's key.
Yes, we got to do that. Okay, you just gave me the topic for part number two is
calling your shots.
Yep. Yeah. Well, good. All right. You have a good evening, Steve. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
No problem. Take care. All right. Bye.